I'm Kevin McCrory, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off. Following a private meeting with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh yesterday, U.S. Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, says he's concerned about the nomination and frustrated with the process. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more from the Delaware desk.
Coons is concerned about Kavanaugh's background and the reason President Trump picked him to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy.
And in particular, whether he was chosen because of his fairly extreme views on executive power and the ability of the executive to avoid accountability.
After the guilty plea of President Trump's longtime lawyer Michael Cohen on tax, banking, and campaign finance charges this week, Coons believes the president could face legal trouble.
I think the likelihood that there will be in the next term or year in the Supreme Court an important issue that comes to the court about whether or not the president can evade accountability for criminal action, I think that's likely to happen. And I'm concerned more than I've been before about Judge Kavanaugh's individual record on presidential accountability. And I think that's something that's should be of concern to everybody.
Confirmation hearings are scheduled, even though documents relating to Kavanaugh's time working in the White House for President George W. Bush haven't been made public. Coons calls it one of his grave frustrations with the process. Coons questioned what those documents say about Kavanaugh's role in key Bush administration decisions concerning government surveillance and the treatment of detainees.
I pressed Judge Kavanaugh on those issues. I didn't get satisfying answers.
Some Democrats have refused to meet with Kavanaugh, in part because they haven't had a chance to review those documents. Coons went forward with his meeting because Democrats won't be able to stop the confirmation hearings September 4th. Coons wouldn't say directly how he'll vote on the nomination, but he says he plans on reading a lot of Kavanaugh's decisions and available writings before the hearings start. From the Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Government accountability has been on the minds of many this week. After the conviction in the Paul Manafort case and guilty plea in the Michael Cohen case, talks ramped up about the potential for President Trump to face impeachment. Our Dave Heller sat down with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, for context on the nation's history with those proceedings.
Frank, why don't we look at history to test the public mood and appetite for going down that road?
Well, there have been two presidents who've been impeached by the House of Representatives, Andrew Johnson, and unfortunately, we don't have much polling from that period of time after the Civil War. The other was Bill Clinton, where we do have polling that we can look at, Dave. Compared to Clinton, I would say Trump is in worse position. He had very high approval ratings, particularly after the process started in 1998, after the revelations about Monica Lewinsky began to be public. His approval rating actually rose up to as high as 70% as the process unfolded. We had a very nice economy at that time, and the percent of Americans who were satisfied with the way things were going was considerably higher then than it is now under Trump, even though we have a good economy now. Trump's approval rating, as we well know, is in the low 40% range. Clinton's was much higher. We also had a lot of polling back then asking, should Clinton be impeached? And a significant majority of Americans said no. I just reviewed the polling that's been done by a number of firms who have asked about Donald Trump and impeachment. And basically, we get the same kind of partisan split that we're getting on approval rating. But some polls show it even. Some show a little more opposed than in favor. But basically, I think that the sentiment saying yes to impeachment for Trump, probably because we're so polarized today, is higher than it was for Clinton. So comparing those two, I would say Trump is in a worse position than was Bill Clinton back in 1998, 1999.
Meanwhile, the Mueller investigation grinds on, looking into the extent of involvement of Russia in the U.S. election. Do most Americans want it to play out to its logical end?
Yes, I just reviewed a bunch of polling on that, and I can't find any poll, basically, that says that it should be shut down. Most Americans may not agree with it, may think it's biased, but nevertheless say, yes, it should go on to its culmination.
Do most Americans think that it's biased?
Well, the data that I look at say that's very partisan, like so much else in America. Not Gallup polling, but other polling that I've looked at really says that Americans are following the lead of their party, their underlying political and ideological sensitivities when they respond to that question. If you're a Republican, you say it's biased. If you're a Democrat, you don't.
We've invoked the term polarized and biased. These are all very emotionally laden terms. Is it possible to measure whether Americans are more emotionally involved in politics now than before?
Well, one measure we have says they are. We went back in our Gallup poll vault. We looked back in 1965 at a question we asked. We said, do you ever have the urge to join a protest or public demonstration? And back then, believe it or not, only 10% said yes. And this was 1965, just as the Vietnam War was beginning to really ratchet up. We just re-asked the question, and now 36% say yes. It's Democrats and liberals who are most likely to say they want to protest something. Not surprising, since the Republicans control the White House and both houses of Congress. It's not surprising that the people on the out, that is the Democrats, would be more likely to want to protest. But we then ask people, well, what is it you would want to protest about if you could go out into the streets? And here's what we found. Number one thing people would protest about today is women's rights, the Me Too movement. Number two, immigration issues. And a lot of those are Democrats who are protesting separation of children from parents and things along those lines. Number three is gun control. Number four is people who would protest Trump himself and the presidency. That's tied with people who say their protest would be about civil rights. And it's also tied with those who said they would be protesting about global warming and the environment.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Four years ago, Andrew Brooking was part of a new wave of teachers at Blaine Elementary in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia. The group was tasked with a turnaround in academics and culture. Brooking was featured prominently in a radio documentary I did on that first year of the turnaround. He's still at Blaine, and this year will be his first as assistant principal. He joins us now to discuss his progress. Andrew Brooking, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
So this will be your ninth year working in Philadelphia public schools, and you've been in some of the highest needs, highest poverty areas of the city. When your alarm bell goes off on Monday morning, first day of classes, what's going to be driving you through the day, the week, the months, the year?
Deep down, the passion that brought me here to begin with in 2010, and also my experiences as a kid myself, growing up in upstate New York in a rural, high poverty, very conservative, almost bigoted community, which I removed myself from and made myself educated in California. And then through that experiences, meeting children in classes as I was tutoring.
Tell me more about the kids in Strawberry Mansion, the kids that you've been serving for these years.
Yeah, they're vibrant. I think the greatest thing is they're able to bounce back a lot easier than adults do. But they do have troubles, obviously, that other kids might not. Lots of trauma.
So when we talked during the 2014-15 school year, it was clear that education is a profession that you take very seriously. You're working 12-hour days, and your focus on helping these kids really seemed to be like the top priority in your life. I asked you then if what you were doing was sustainable. Here's what you said.
Is it sustainable? I don't know. I think for me, I personally don't see myself teaching, right, 10 years from now.
How do you feel now? What goes through your mind listening to that?
I think it's very in line where I am actually still. I think it's a day-to-day process, honestly. I think sustainability is something I'm working on. That's my goal right now, that I'm trying to find that balance between work and life.
And knowing what you know now about, you know, going into a very intense community and trying to make a difference for, you know, a young person who's thinking about becoming a teacher, what advice would you give them?
Definitely know what you're getting into. Know that it is not the TV movies that you see. We had teachers, particularly last year, who would come and they weren't prepared for our community and prepared for the needs that our kids have. And then they would leave. This past spring, when we were doing hiring, it was very clear about who we were looking for and being very transparent about the type of job that they're signing up for, as well as our desire to keep teachers here. We want, you know, Blaine to be a place where, you know, you have the same teachers for years. So he's like, oh, I had this teacher in second grade, Miss Walker in third. It doesn't need to be changing every year. So explaining that to the teachers and letting them know, like, that we want you in for the long haul.
So now we're heading into the fifth school year since this turnaround at Blaine took place. The original idea is that with some extra funding, a big revamp in staff, the school would be able to much better serve the students in this neighborhood. when we talked that first year, you made very clear the high expectations you had in mind for what needed to be happening in that school. Here's another clip from the documentary.
So I'll talk to my other leadership members, and they're like, oh, you should have seen last year. Like, this is, you know, and I'm like, so? I'm like thinking, you know, we need to keep pushing. We need to, like, this is not good enough. And I think that's been the consistent thing in my head is, like, we are not there. We are not close.
So now years later, the extra funding, which was from philanthropy, has dried up. You've seen a good bit of teacher turnover, and the school's standardized test scores are still pretty low. So how do you gauge the success of what's been happening at Blaine since you've been there?
I think success is a process. I don't know if it's, you know, black or white, yes or no. I believe that the progress was made in a number of teachers' mindsets and shifts in how we do the work. There was significant progress prior to where the funding was removed. You know, it's like we were getting there. So like when I hear that quote, it's like, God, we're not there yet. And we were much closer on that third year. It's almost like that we were there, and then the step was, it was taken away. So we had to kind of start back over again. Right?
So you said last year was a particularly difficult year.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. In terms of teacher vacancies, we started out the year. There was some medical leave that took place. And then some of our new teachers who I was speaking about just a minute ago who didn't know what they were getting into. And even after some coaching and developing, it just didn't align. That created a huge lift on us. On top of all of the funding that we were missing, we now had holes in our building. I remember the beginning of the year last year just walking around and just, you know, no teachers, right? So we have subs in there with kids, and like, you can't have that in the beginning of the year. So just starting out the year like that, imagining what the end of the year ended up to be. And our data does speak to exactly what had happened. You know, we stayed
in that there was a decline.
Exactly. Yeah. Academically. So we really just focused on attendance and climate last year because we knew our academics. We don't have teachers in front of the class right now.
How frustrating is that?
It was really bad. Yeah.
You have parents who are trusting the school, sending their kids there, and literally they're substitutes.
Yeah. It was really rough. And so luckily through that process, though, we found two substitutes who are now full-time teachers at Blaine this year. It's not all negative, you know, but it's like when you have those holes in the teachers, you're right. The parents come up and it's a right to teach their kids. And as administrators, you can't even say that the parents are wrong because they're all right, you know, like in that sense. Their children deserve a teacher to be there.
What's the best part of your job?
Kids. Being with them. I think all summer long I've been working with adults. I've realized like how much I miss the kids, right? Like I've been used to working and I always see kids every day and you don't think about it. Now it's like all summer, I'm kind of sick of adults.
Well, Andrew Brooking, thank you for being here.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
That was Andrew Brooking, assistant principal of Blaine Elementary School in Philadelphia's Strawberry Mansion neighborhood. Classes start Monday. North Philadelphia's Freedom Theater is in serious danger after months without heat or power. It has relocated performances and is working to make major repairs. As Jake Blumgart of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, the theater is trying to survive in the face of changes in the neighborhood.
Jarius Parker remembers when he got the phone call about the flood. It was 5 a.m. on January 11th, and he rushed to the stately North Broad Street mansion to find water gushing down the walls. Parker works at the Freedom Theater as a sound engineer. Standing in the 100-seat black box theater at the back of the building, he looks at splotches of water damage on the ceiling and a floor warped by the deluge.
This whole room here was flooded out and frozen, actually, with ice for most of the winter.
For a long time, the theater's heating and cooling system only kind of worked. And when it didn't keep the attic warm enough in January, pipes froze and then burst, causing the flood. They even had to cut off the building's electricity. The Freedom Theater is a historic African-American institution in what was once the heart of Black Philadelphia. But even before the January flood, it was almost $1 million in debt from previous repairs. And the surrounding neighborhood has changed rapidly too, says Executive Director Sandra Houghton.
This whole neighborhood is gentrified, I would say. It's completely different from when Freedom Theater took over this building, but 40 years ago. And so now it's mostly Temple students, very few residents live here.
It's hard not to hear the construction of a new 17-story residential building coming from next door. It towers over the Freedom Theater, and the construction blocks much of the neighboring sidewalk. But passersby still wander in off the street to ask after the theater's fate.
Can I help you?
Yes, Freedom Theater.
Yes.
Is it still open? Is it
closed? Yes. That's a question Freedom Theater gets asked a lot. They only got the electricity back on in June, and the theater's programming had to be dispersed to other locations. So the answer is yes, the organization is open, but the building needs $3 million in repairs before this North Philadelphia icon is operational again. Houghton has secured a $500,000 state grant, but she needs a matching $500,000 to get the new heating and cooling system installed. She doesn't want to face another winter here without heat, and has faith that something will come through. It has to.
I think it's really important for cities with a rich historic cultural aspect to really preserve and maintain their historic footprint, because once it's gone, it's gone.
And Houghton would know. Once North Broad Street was lined with Gilded Age mansions, now Freedom Theater is one of the last standing. Jake Blumgart, WHYY News.
For centuries, scientists, amateur botanists, and others scoured the country to document and preserve plant species. Their collections were prized, like fine art. As State Impact Pennsylvania Susan Phillips reports, there's a new effort to digitize all this information, and it could be a boon for researchers.
On the fifth floor of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, in a cool, windowless room that smells a little pungent, tall metal cabinets store some of the most famous dead plants in the world.
So this is called Grandelia squarosa.
Rick McCourt is the botany curator here, and he reads the notes scribbled around this dried and pressed pretty yellow flower.
And so it says prairies in the camp near the old Maha village, that's a Native American village, September 17, 1804.
Members of the Lewis and Clark expedition collected this medicinal flower. This herbarium, like a library for plants, is the oldest in North America. McCourt says it has more than 1 million dried plants collected by explorers, botanists, and citizen scientists over the past 400 years.
I almost think of it like any collector, like, you know, baseball trading cards. I mean, it was a competitive game to see if you could describe a lot of new species, find a lot of new species, make them valuable to the people you're either working for or your own reputation scientifically. And there were different levels of vanity associated with it, I would say.
These collections are difficult to access. But now, there's a massive effort to photograph and make available online hundreds of thousands of plants housed in about a dozen institutions on the East Coast. It's called the Mid-Atlantic Megalopolis Project. McCourt says hundreds of years of plant data could answer questions about conservation, climate change, and development.
But like, how has the environment changed? What plants occur where? Do they occur someplace differently now than they used to? Are they vanished or gone from an area?
He says it might even raise the possibility of using plant DNA to bring back extinct species.
It's more like a Jurassic Park dream. But DNA is DNA. Who knows? Before 1952, we wouldn't have known what DNA was, right? And much less that you could get it out of museum specimens.
At Muhlenberg College, ecologist Rich Niesenbaum just finished adding its plant collection to the database. He's using it to track down a rare and possibly endangered plant called the flat-stemmed pondweed. But going by the centuries-old handwritten notes isn't easy.
It's a grass, an aquatic grass, growing in Cedar Creek south of Fairview Street.
The notes also mention a quarry, and there's only one in Allentown, so he's pretty confident he knows where to go. We head to Cedar Creek, where thickets of reeds and cattails line the banks.
There's a lot of poison ivy here.
I don't see any grass down in here.
Crowding out everything else are invasive species like Japanese knotweed and stilt grass. One reason why some of these native plants are endangered. But then he does spot the rare grass.
All right, I'm getting in the creek.
Oh, that's refreshing.
Yeah, I think we'll take this back to the lab and take a look at it.
So does it surprise you to even find it here?
Yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, that's exciting because as a plant hunter, right, we spend a lot more time hunting and looking than actually finding if this is indeed the rare plant and it's here right in an urban environment, in an urban setting, that offers a lot of hope.
Niesenbaum says he'll grow it in the lab to make sure it's a match. If so, it will be added to the database, minus the exact location. Because the plant's at risk of being extinct, that will be kept a secret. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
No secret that is all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by the trio of Scheiben Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and the man behind the glass tonight, Brett Rader. We had production assistance this week from Edward Saakashvili. The news director is Eugene San. Our assistant news director is Katie Culinary. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, Adam Staniszewski, and the other man behind the glass today, Mike Villers. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Kevin McCrory for NewsWorks Tonight.